equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettmeyer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. It's my end of the summer vacation. I'm currently on my way to an undisclosed location cut off from electronic communication. Here are a couple interviews from Midsummer Week, June 22nd, that are just as relevant today as a couple months ago. Tom Scazzi learned how to make money by selling people worm poop in reused plastic bottles. And the worm poop itself was manufactured, if that's what you call it. It was manufactured from garbage. Compostable food waste, that is. He's taken that business model and he's expanded it to find all sorts of ways to make money from other people's garbage. He even pays postage for people to send him their garbage. We'll talk to Tom about his business model and his book, Revolution in a Bottle. Before that, we'll talk to Vermonter Teresa Snow, who turns food waste directly into people food, using people as workers, not worms. Snow founded the gleaning program Salvation Farms, which went around to farms and farmers' markets in the Northeast Kingdom and harvested food that was perfectly edible and delicious, but just didn't fit into the commercial processes somehow. Now the Vermont Food Bank has hired her, and the program is running statewide. Snow says that so much more could be done to bring unharvested food to the table in Vermont that the amount of rescued food could be expanded 10 times, and there'd still be leftovers. Also on that show, I commented on the notion that was popular across the political spectrum at that time, that oil prices were being driven by speculation. Let's start with that. If you were listening to the Noontime News, you heard Jim Hightower on the left talking about that. If you were listening from 11 to 12, you heard Paul Beaudry and his guests on the right talking about that. Jack McMullen in yesterday's Burlington Free Press was saying, yes, oil prices are being driven up by speculators. He's a Republican couple-time candidate for U.S. Senate. Bernie Sanders, independent socialist U.S. senator, says the same thing. So with that consensus across the ideological spectrum, it's got to be true, right? Well, tain't necessarily the case. I'm working on an article on this subject. I wrote about it a couple times last year, and it's a data-driven article. I'm keeping an open mind about what's happening right now, and I'm trying to gather more data. It's surprisingly difficult to find up-to-date global data on oil production. That's not so hard, but oil demand. You know, if you're looking at supply and demand to find out whether they're driving prices, then you got to be looking at global oil demand to see what that is. And that's hard to find up-to-date data on what's happening in terms of storage of oil. So I'm gathering those data, trying to put together a story of what's happening now. And I'll tell you next week what I've concluded. But last year is very clear that world oil demand exceeded supply, not during a week, not during a month, but over a several-year period. There were stocks being drawn down in 2007, in 2008. And that means that there was more oil being burned up than was being produced over that period. Now, what does that mean about speculations? Well, speculators can raise or lower oil demand a little bit at the margins and thereby affect the price at the margin. And if stocks were being drawn down last year and in 2007, which was also a year of dramatically increasing oil prices, what that means is that the speculators were helping to buffer the run-up in the price. If supply and demand had been allowed to run their course without these previously stockpiled supplies of oil to be drawn down on, then the price run-up would have been even higher. We might have seen not just $147 a barrel oil, we might have seen $200 a barrel oil last year. And yet, some of the same people who are screaming now that speculators are causing the price of oil to rise above $70 a barrel were screaming last year when exactly the opposite thing was happening in the market, that that storage was going down, that speculators were causing the rise. I'm not sure what their theory is about why the price of oil collapsed and how the evil speculators caused that to happen. Anyway, before you buy someone telling you that speculators are driving up the oil prices, ask them, what's the global supply right now? What's the demand? What are the trends in that? What's the trends in storage? Most people write about this. They don't bother to mention that. I don't know if they don't know that or what. I think the price of admission to the conversation on oil prices right now and their causes is knowing what global supply, global demand, and storage rates are. So, update on that next week. Now we'll go to Teresa Snow, who, as I said in the intro, is the founder of Salvation Farms, which is now a program of the Vermont Food Bank. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good to have you on. So, for our listeners who aren't familiar with Salvation Farms, let's just go through the basics, when you founded it, how you got started, and how you became part of the food bank.
Great. I started Salvation Farms officially in 2005 from a side project that I began at Peach Greens and Craftsbury, where I was salvaging surplus produce from his farm and distributing it to some local sites, as well as to the Vermont Food Bank. In 2005, I brought on a co-founder, Jen O'Donnell, who was working on her senior thesis at Sterling College, who helped me found Salvation Farms and make it into a nonprofit project, which was working under the nonprofit status of NOFA Vermont, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And for the next 3 years, Jen and I oversaw the gleaning, which was the salvaging of surplus product from farms in the Lamoille Valley region, and distributing that to local sites that served typically food and nutritionally insecure individuals, as well as supplying the Vermont Food Bank with a large amount of that product. And in the beginning of 2008, it was actually the end of January, I became an employee with the Vermont Food Bank, took the position of Program Director of Agricultural Resources, and Salvation Farms became their gleaning program.
Okay, and how's it gone as being part of the food bank? How has it changed what Salvation Farms has done?
Well, it has really secured the foundation of the gleaning work that was established in the Lamoille Valley. We have someone who replaced my work there. Rebecca Beidler is the gleaning coordinator for that region. And it, by securing that region's gleaning, we've been able to focus on how to strategically expand our gleaning around the state. We have hired someone to coordinate gleaning in the greater Montpelier region. We've hired someone to coordinate gleaning in the greater Brattleboro region, both of which are associated with our facilities. We have facilities in Lamoille Valley, in Barrie, as well as in Brattleboro. And in Brattleboro, we've been able to move pretty easily into that community through a partnership with Post Oil Solutions through part of their food security initiatives. And we've also partnered with the Burlington's Intervale Center and their gleaning project, which has been part of their Healthy Cities program. So we're out there gleaning, you know, kind of across the state in major populated areas or high density farming areas, and you know, we're looking at how much more we want to expand. I think we're at this point we're being quite cautious about where to expand next, and at this point, let's see that where we're at is successful and you know, showing benefit to the network partners of the food bank and the farms that we're serving in those areas before we look to other regions around the state.
So what does gleaning look like? Give us an example. You show up at 8 a.m. on some local farm to glean spinach late in June. What happens?
Well, we can either have a very loose arrangement with farms, or we can have a very regular arrangement, formal arrangement with farms. So if, let's say we're going to a farm to pick spinach, it may be a farm that we go to every week, and our gleaning coordinator will send out an announcement to all of the volunteers that they have on file, and they will meet at a specific location at a specific time, and everybody signs in and makes sure all their paperwork's done, and you just harvest what is there as surplus.
You need to do paperwork to glean?
Well, you kind of do. With volunteers, there's different liability, and we want to keep track of how many volunteers we have, how much time they invest. All of that's really helpful for grant writing, certainly.
Okay. Okay.
But to know the level of involvement that we have around some of our programs.
Okay, so you sign the papers, and then you go out into the fields.
You get right into the field, and it's hard to get everyone in the mindset of doing any paperwork, because they're there, they're ready to work, and they want to get into the field, and so you. You basically pick until you've picked everything that's available. Or with greens, it's a good example, is that you want to get there early while it's still the cool part of the day, while there's still dew on the greens.
They're still nice and crisp.
Exactly. Once you hit 10 to 11, all of that dew's burnt off, and then the moisture starts getting sucked out of those leaves, so that might call the end of your glean. You may also, and this is where our gleaning coordinators are, their skill is highly valued, is that they can say, well, can our network absorb this? And perishables are extremely, you need to be pretty sensitive with them as far as your turnover time. So knowing how many crops you have, what the volume is, and where it's going to go to in the next week all really guides a field coordinator, a gleaning coordinator, on how much spinach do we want to take. We don't always clear it all, but that's also the great part of being within the Vermont Food Bank, is that if it can't be distributed in that local region, it can always be absorbed into distribution throughout the entire state. We serve about 270 different agencies around the state, and that's a lot of sites that serve a lot of Vermonters.
And with the spinach coming fresh to the food bank from the farm that very morning, then I expect you have a little bit more time window to get it distributed throughout the state than if you had gotten stuff donated from a shipment from California or somewhere.
Yeah, you do. Yep, you do. You certainly do. And especially if it's picked with quality in mind and it's handled properly, it certainly has a little bit more shelf life than something that's been picked and possibly been on a store shelf already and then rescued, and then we need to figure out where that product goes.
This is Equal Time Radio on WDEV. I'm Carl Etnayer. Our guest today is Teresa Snow. She's part of the Salvation Farms program, founded Salvation Farms program a number of years ago. It's now part of the Vermont Food Bank. If you'd like to ask her a question about gleaning, give us a call, 244-1777, or tell us a story of gleaning yourself. Our toll-free number is 877-291-8255. So let's go back to the spinach field. What's happened ahead of time? Has there been mechanical harvest of the spinach? Has there been human harvest of the spinach? What's happened to leave things that need to be gleaned?
Right. Well, that's a great question. It could just be surplus.
Okay.
It could be already, like you said, mechanically harvested or hand harvested. Farmers, especially with a product like spinach, will plant succession. So that's planting every week or every 2 weeks to ensure that they always have the right quality and right quantity of certain products. So a bed of spinach may have been already cut once to, three or more times, depending on the scale of a farm.
Mm-hmm.
A bed of spinach may not even have been cut because it may have come through, maybe been damaged by hail, might have been affected by pest. It may not look as good as the next round that's coming or another bed down the way. So it could be the first cut that we're gleaning because it's not a quality, cosmetic quality suitable for consumer or first or the market.
Okay.
But oftentimes it's been cut and farmers are moving on to their next planting.
So the spinach or whatever the vegetable is that's not of cosmetic quality, is that something you find in the field or do you get that after the farmers have cut it and then sort it out before they take their food to the market?
Right. That's another great question. We'll find that both in the field, but we also work with farmers to salvage things from their wash or pack houses. Mm-hmm. So farmers often with things like cucumbers and summer squash will have their employees go through the field and just pick everything that's ready.
Mm.
They don't cull it, sort out the unmarketables. They don't cull it in the field, and they'll wait till they get it inside, and then they're packing it into boxes that they say, oh, that one doesn't look so great. That one has a scar. That one's growing funny. And then they'll sort them aside and put them in typically totes that we will supply them with, and then we go to the farm and pick up that product.
Mm. Now, your colleague at the food bank, David Thurlow, was on WDEV a week and a half ago or so, I believe, on the Mark Johnson Show.
Excellent.
And he was talking about the dilemma that the food bank has faced in that as they've gotten better at taking the dented cans and things like that and making good use of those, giving them to people who need them, then the market has responded and said, hey, we can make a buck off of these dented cans. And also people have gotten better at controlling inventory and things like that, so that there's not as much food coming into the food bank this way. I'm wondering, I mean, Salvation Farms, the gleaning program, it's only been around for 5 years or so in Vermont, but are you seeing that the market is responding and saying, hey, you know, the food bank is getting this food that we could be making a buck off of, and your gleaning possibilities are starting to decline?
I don't see that as of yet. I think that if we increase the infrastructure in our state for value added and processing, then products that aren't first quality have a second market.
Right.
But as a lot of our vegetable farmers are marketing the raw product, they need prime quality.
Mm.
And I think that your statement about kind of quoting David Thurlow on traditionally food banks have been about rescuing food, and in doing so, the food industry has realized what kind of surpluses they're creating and have kind of refined their procedures and processes so that they're not producing such a surplus. And we are finding a shortage of available food out there across the country. So I think gleaning is a great remedy for that, in that when we don't have food processors in state yet, at least not at a large scale, it is our farmers who are producing a majority of the food that would be generating surplus in state for us to garner as donations.
And just because of the vagaries of biological systems, it's a lot more difficult for farmers to tighten their operations and say, okay, we're going to produce exactly as much food as the market needs this year.
Yeah, and you can never tell. And as I alluded to earlier, is that farmers want to produce enough to fill all of the demand, and so they often overproduce, or they want to produce enough so that if something were to happen to a portion of their crop, they still have enough.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Teresa Snow, director of the Salvation Farms Gleaning Program at the Vermont Food Bank, before we go any further, let's get out information to our listeners about how they can get involved in this program if they want to show up early in the morning and be a pair of hands to glean some food from some spinach from a field, for example.
Great. I'm not quite sure your listening range, so I'm going to... Northern half of Vermont, great. Well, for anyone interested in volunteering with the Vermont Food Bank, you can contact Patrick Gilbert. He's our volunteer coordinator for the entire organization for all of our facilities and programs. His direct line is 802-477-4127.
That's 477-4127, Patrick Gilbert.
Yeah. for our Montpelier area gleaning coordinator, if you live in the greater Montpelier area.
Let's just go with a one name for now, just to make it easier, and also a website.
That's great. Vermont Food Bank. That's www.vtfoodbank.org.
vtfoodbank.org. And apologies to our listeners in Quebec, New York, and New Hampshire. We do get off into those areas as well, but I just didn't mention them because I figured they're going to be less likely to come to fields in Vermont and do some gleaning. Right. But certainly they'd be welcome to come over the border if they wanted to.
Yes, certainly.
Okay, so how much food do you glean each year? And I realize this is really the first year, 2009 is the first year that you've really gone statewide, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so last year, say 2008, realizing the program was much smaller, how much food
right.
did you glean?
Last year we were able to bring in 160,000 pounds gleaned and donated. So that was food that was set aside, not necessarily gleaned physically from the field, but a total of 160,000 pounds. Prior to that, between the years of 2005 to 2007, before joining the food bank, Salvation Farms had only been able to glean 88,000 pounds in the Lamoille Valley. So it was a substantial jump in the first year.
Right, almost doubling.
Yeah.
And then put that in context for us, please. How much food does the food bank distribute each year?
Well, last year we distributed roughly 7 million pounds of food.
Okay, so we got a ways to go before gleaning will cover even half of that.
We certainly do, yep.
And also, I just wanted to put in a plug. You talked about donated food. The food bank at their place in Barrie will accept donations of food from people who've planted an extra row or for whatever reason have extra food, correct?
Yes, and all of our facilities, the Woolkit, the Brattleboro, the Barrie branch certainly will be willing to take any food donated, whether it's perishable or shelf-stable. Mm. And we also encourage for home gardeners, there's the Grow an Extra Row program. They could build a relationship directly with their local food pantry, too, to increase that efficiency and support their community in that way.
And the food pantries, you can find them through the Vermont Food Bank website, if
exactly.
I remember correctly. And
yep.
That's
yep.
vtfoodbank.org, and I expect Patrick Gilbert would be willing to help you out if you don't have web access.
Yes.
That's 477-4127 to talk to Patrick Gilbert, the volunteer coordinator at the Vermont Food Bank.
Great.
And then farmers markets are another source of food for the food bank, correct?
Yeah, we do some gleaning at farmers markets, again, where those field coordinators are located. And I think that's a good service to farms in that there's some product that farmers will take to farmers markets that they can return to the farm with and incorporate into a farm stand or into another market. But then there's also a lot of food that they don't really want to take back to the farm because it'll just have to go into the compost pile. So that food we can glean and then make great diverse kind of mixed boxes and then distribute those in that region.
Hmm. And Teresa Snow, what would you say is the potential for gleaning in Vermont?
Oh, I think it's huge. I think that if we have the volunteer support to make the work that we do, purchasing field trucks, hiring field gleaning coordinators, the cold storage, and equipping our in-house employees and workers the ability to care for this product and turn it over, and as well as the network partners infrastructure for them to turn it over and have this product in good quality to be received. I think increasing the efficiency, increasing the labor on fields through volunteers, we can serve more farms in a way that farms are satisfied and are going to be proud to participate and want to have us return to their fields.
Do you think you've reached 10% of the potential now?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. At 160,000 pounds per year, you haven't reached 10% of the potential.
So I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
That's a lot of potential out there.
I think there is a lot of potential, and we're seeing small farms, not so small farms, but small and U.S. scale farms that are increasingly diversified become more and more aggressive and efficient food producers. And by growing products when you're trying to market the best quality, you're going to have surplus. And we need to make this easy for farms. If it's not easy for them, then it's easier just to till it in, which is good for the soil, but you know, there's many people that could be eating some really healthy food.
Absolutely. Well, Amanda Payne is a Central Vermont field representative. I'm on her email list, and she says that tomorrow, if you're in the East Montpelier or Plainfield area or want to get there at 8 a.m., there's a small spinach glean. And that's at 8 a.m., only 5 boxes, so only 1 or 2 volunteers needed for an hour. So let her know or contact Peter Gilbert, since we've been giving out his phone number, 477-4127, if you'd like to be a part of that. And I'll put in a plug. There's another small, not really a glean, but a harvest. As many listeners know, Vermont is the first state in the nation to have planted a vegetable garden on the State House lawn. And the food from that vegetable garden is going to the Montpelier Food Pantry. The first harvest of that will be tomorrow at 8 a.m. The lettuce, which was grown originally in plugs by the students at the Montpelier High School in their greenhouse, will be harvested and taken to the food pantry. So if you'd like to be a part of that, show up at the State House at 8 a.m.
Wow, that's excellent.
Yeah, I was part of the group that put that together, and we're really proud that we've gotten to this point. And the plants look fantastic there. We've got some nice Vermont Compost Company compost there, good soil from years of good treatment, and I don't know, maybe just some good feeling from the peoples of Vermont. It's a people's lawn there outside the people's house, and
right.
The plants have been doing very well.
Right, to feed the people.
That's right.
Noble cause.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Teresa Snow, Director of Salvation Farms at the Vermont Food Bank. Anything you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I certainly appreciate the time you've taken to have me on, and I'd encourage anyone that wants to come out and help the Vermont Food Bank reach its mission. You're very welcome to do so, whether that's at one of our facilities or in the field. We can always use an extra set of hands to help out your neighbors who can't meet their food needs.
Very good. Thank you for your important work, Teresa Snow.
Great. Thank you too, Carl.
And one more time, Patrick Gilbert is the volunteer coordinator for the Vermont Food Bank. His phone number is 477-4127. And you can find out all about the volunteer opportunities, including the gleaning opportunities, available through the Vermont Food Bank at their website. That's vtfoodbank.org. Coming up, we're going to be talking with Tom Scazzi. He's the author of a book called Revolution in a Bottle. It's about how he started selling worm poop in reused plastic bottles when he dropped out of Princeton University, not even 10 years ago. And he's building a national company that is founded on selling garbage to people, literally. We'll hear from Tom Scazzi in just a moment.
Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettnayer, and I'm on vacation this week. So we're rebroadcasting some interviews from June. Our next guest is Tom Scazzi. He's the author of Revolution in a Bottle. He started a business selling worm poop in reused plastic bottles to build a national company using garbage.
Tom, welcome to the show. The PR material that I've seen says that you're a 27-year-old entrepreneur, but that sometimes changes. Can we still say that?
Well, no, I'm still 27 for a while, so
okay.
That's absolutely accurate.
Okay, so why don't you begin by telling us why you dropped out of an Ivy League university to sell worm poop?
Well, I mean, so yeah, I was going to Princeton my freshman year, and my friends, they were growing these plants in their basement in Montreal. I'm originally Canadian, not American. And so, you know, I went up to Montreal to visit my friends and check out their plants. Obviously, you know, I was very excited about this. And when I got there, the plants were growing way better than I ever expected. And it was primarily due because they were feeding worm poop to these plants. And what was amazing more than all that was that they were taking organic waste and feeding it to the worms. That's how they were actually making the worm poop itself. And that got me incredibly excited about this idea of garbage. You know, garbage is an idea that doesn't exist in nature. It's an entirely man-made concept, and we're basically paying to get rid of garbage and producing a negative all the way around, economical, environmental, social negative. And so I got really into the idea of garbage. Within 6 months, I ended up dropping out of school to build TerraCycle, which started as a worm poop company. We still do make worm poop, and we're the leaders in organic fertilizer today. But from there, it really grew and ballooned to a company that solves for every type of waste out there, whether it's juice pouches or candy wrappers or sponges or tape dispensers. I mean, TerraCycle more or less is the solution for all garbage. And we're doing that waste stream by waste stream.
That's an ambitious agenda. There must be some types of garbage that are not really designed to be broken down. And how do you deal with those?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we just actually inked a deal with a major, I think if not the biggest, then it's the second biggest pen company in the world. And we're going to start collecting pens. And pens is a great example where it's not an easy product to deal with. There's so many different plastics and metals and rubbers in a pen that what we do in these complex materials is we do what we call deassembly recycling. So we deassemble the pen into its basic components, just basic material components, and then everything, when you get a lot of anything, it's easy to solve for. So then we recycle it and make it into a product. At this point, frankly, TerraCycle has not seen a waste stream it could not work with. And I mean, we've seen a lot of different things and are working with a lot of different things, and so far there's not been one that we couldn't solve. And what's interesting, just to sort of touch on this a little bit, is that there are three basic ways that every type of waste in the world, as long as it's consumer-type waste, can be solved. A lot of things can be upcycled, and that means taking a juice pouch and sewing it together like we do with Capri Sun, or taking a Frito-Lay chip bag and weaving it, or, you know, so on and so forth. The idea of upcycling is that you don't break down the material in any way. You value every part of the waste as value, and you make a product from it. With rigid packaging, you can refill with a different content, like our worm poop or our cleaners. All of TerraCycle's liquids are actually packaged in new soda bottles. We have yogurt cups that we're putting out in the marketplace that are doubling as planting pots. And these are all done, mind you, in very big scales, you know, sold at Walmart, Home Depot, Target, these really big box retailers. And then complex polymers or complex products, if you will, razor blades, coffee cartridges, pens, furnace filters, all go into what we call deassembly recycling, and every type of waste basically can be solved in one of those three ways.
Okay, I got upcycling, I got deassembly recycling, and is just reuse the third one in the middle?
I would say refill. Yeah,
refill.
But it's refill with a different content. And one way to look at this is like, what's the difference between a chapstick tube and a glue stick? Really, you know, I think the only difference is just the content of what's in it. Everything else is exactly the same. And so we look for these similarities and package, you know, different content in rigid packaging.
What about just taking beer bottles and filling them up with beer again?
Well, that's reuse. But, you know, one of the challenges is that especially one of the most, one of the largest waste streams out there is food type waste stream, food packaging. Mm. And food packaging cannot be reused except in the odd case of like glass, which can be refilled. And there's already a great infrastructure for that. But in any plastic food packaging, which is what over 90% of how our food is packaged, plastic cannot be reused because of the way the FDA has its guidelines for great reasons. It's hard to make it completely safe from a consumer perspective if you just repackage food. So repackaging is and reuse from that perspective is very limited in what is legally allowed to be done.
Yeah, you can subject glass to some pretty severe heat treatment that most plastic packaging probably wouldn't stand up to, I would guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically not feasible, as an example, to take a plastic Coke bottle and refill it with Coke again.
But the worm poop, because people are not going to consume the worm poop, at least they're advised not to by the label, I assume, then you can fill that into the plastic Coke bottle.
Right, exactly.
Now, I used to live over in Sweden and Norway, and there they had, for the equivalent of 12-ounce beer bottles and soda bottles, they were really closer to 11 ounces, they had standardized bottles, so it really didn't matter which bottler or beer brewer you bought from, they were pretty much the same bottles. They could be used interchangeably, and that made for a really robust recycling system. If we had a system like that in the U.S., would that make your job harder, or would that just... Or easier? I could see that it might, you know, drive you out of a niche in the market.
Well, put it this way, we're working on every type of branded waste out there. Even in advanced countries, and you know, especially in Europe, which has probably one of the most advanced recycling infrastructures out there, the amount of stuff that can be recycled is still a small percentage compared to the stuff that cannot be recycled. So even if there's great solutions that come up in the world of recycling, I've welcome them and hope they happen. It takes a little bit away from us, but nothing that would affect us in any way.
There's enough garbage to go around out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A chip bag in any country in the world is not recyclable unless TerraCycle is bringing its program forward.
We're talking with Tom Zaki. He is the author of Revolution in a Bottle, How TerraCycle is Redefining Green Business. You're tuned to WDEV. This is Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenayer. Join us at 244-1777 if you'd like to be part of the conversation, or toll free 877-291-8255. So Tom Zaki, you said that you have been able to solve every challenge, to do something useful with every waste stream that you've come across. What are some of the biggest challenges you've faced?
Honestly, it's the more complex waste streams are a little bit more challenging. The two most recent examples have been pens and razor blades and razors. Both of those we end up doing, you know, the de-assembly work with. But once we really invented the idea of going after and de-assembling waste and recycling it, which is actually not our unique idea, but once we started incorporating that solution, then it became very easy to solve for most type of waste out there. It's hard to say that there's really been, you know, a challenge that has been insurmountable, because actually the type of stuff that we throw out isn't all that complicated to begin with. The consumer-based products are pretty simple in how they're made and how they're packaged. A lot of plastic. It's a tremendous amount of plastic that's used. And as long as you can figure out how to work with these different plastics, you're absolutely fine.
So what did you do with the pens? What did you do with the pens once you took them apart on all these different plastics and metals in them?
Well, what we do then is we sort out the plastics and metals by their polymer type. So we'll separate, say, polypropylene from PET, these two different plastic formats, into separate buckets. And then once we've accumulated enough of those raw materials, we then sell them to another company that then makes new products out of them under the TerraCycle brand. So, you know, you'll see a line of trash cans next year that are made from recycled pens, literally.
And will they be exclusively recycled pens, or might I get a recycled bicycle water bottle or something like that in there as well?
We typically will keep the waste streams in the finished product. We keep them sort of together, if you will. We don't mix too much of them together. So we're going to be releasing a trash can next year that's made from 100% melted chip bags, which has never been done before. And then we'll do a different one out of pens.
So how come no one's done this before? Or have they?
They haven't, because they haven't. It's not about... The hard part here, frankly, isn't how do you solve for garbage. The hard part is how do you get the garbage to begin with. And that's the big revolution in TerraCycle, is that today you can go to TerraCycle's website, terracycle.net, sign up to collect any waste stream you want to collect. Let's say you sign up for chip bags or candy wrappers or juice pouches, whatever you want. We then send you a box. You fill it up with, you know, a lot of juice pouches, chip bags, or candy wrappers, whatever the waste stream you signed up for, and you can sign up for more than one. You then send it back. The shipping is free to you or to your group. You can sign up your office, your school, whatever. And when we get it, we then go, I think, a little bit above, and we even donate 2 cents per unit of waste to your organization for collecting the garbage. And it's sort of like perpetual reverse Netflix for garbage. We'll collect about 1 billion units of waste this year from about 5 million people across the country, and this program is doubling in size every 6 months. And what's really cool about this entire thing is that it's the big companies like Kraft, Mars, Frito-Lay, and our other really amazing large company partners who pay for all this to happen. So it's one thing to come up with the solutions for waste, but I'd argue that's easier than creating an infrastructure for collecting it all, and luckily that's what we've cracked in this whole idea. So, you know, if you're listening, you can go to TerraCycle.net, sign up, and get paid to collect your garbage.
Why do these big companies like M&M Mars pay to have people send you their wrappers?
Because right now the candy wrapper has no choice on it. You know, if I give you a soda bottle today, it doesn't mean you're going to recycle it or throw it out, but you have the choice to do one or the other. And I think something around 1 in 4 Americans choose to recycle, and 3 out of 4 choose to throw it out. But a candy wrapper doesn't have any solution. So Mars isn't giving that choice to their consumers, but now with TerraCycle, they are giving that choice in a very big way. And they're putting the program on their package. We're on around 2 billion packages right now with this message. And it's all about them giving the choice. And that is the really important part for all these companies, to create a choice for the consumer to do something other than throwing it out.
So they're using it as a marketing strategy.
Well, it is absolutely marketing, without question. But what they're finding is that spending money on creating a solution to their packaging, that dollar goes much further than if they spent that on another TV campaign. And frankly, it's nice because it's also better for the environment.
So you've got all this garbage being mailed to you from around the country, around the world. What do I know? Any legal restrictions on that?
Well, there's always some fun things. I mean, we're about to launch something with some pharmaceutical brands where there are restrictions on how it can be mailed. I mean, we have a whole department that deals with the transportation of waste and all its fun, you know, challenges. So, that's absolutely a part of it. But all in all, it's relatively simple. We also have our program now in the UK, Canada, Mexico, and Brazil. So we are taking it global and collecting, you know, larger parts of the world's waste every day. And hopefully, what we hope to achieve at the end of all this is to create a system where every type of waste in the world has a solution to it, and it can be collected and it can be made into something else. Because then if we do that, in theory, you can almost eliminate the entire idea of garbage that way. I know it's sort of a crazy idea, but it is possible if it's taken to its extreme.
About 20 years ago or so, there was a big to-do about the percentage of our landfill space that was being taken up by dirty disposable diapers. And I think the percentage was in the low single digits, but it was still seen as one of the bigger single waste streams heading to landfills. How would TerraCycle handle dirty disposable diapers?
You know, there may be one that we haven't actually thought about yet. We are partnering with one of the biggest diaper companies. You'll see this actually launching in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But we're going to be collecting the plastic wrap that the diapers are packaged in, which is the easier part. There are solutions to diapers. The bigger challenge to it is the actual transportation. We haven't found a shipping company willing to actually ship dirty diapers through their system. We will crack that, and then at some point we'll be able to help bring a solution to dirty diapers, but not there yet. That's one that we haven't quite gotten to.
Well, I was working for more than 15 years in the water and wastewater industry, and one of the things that I was working on was the contents of dirty diapers are eminently recyclable. You said at the beginning of this show, Tom Zaki, there is no garbage in nature, and what comes out of our body is not garbage. It's not waste. It's full of nutrients, and it's just a matter of finding a way to reuse it in a way that's safe for others.
No, absolutely. I think that's the key, is that people realize that garbage is an illusion. And we've created garbage because we haven't created solutions to it. That's the basic challenge. And when we start looking at waste differently and realize that these are valuable things we're throwing out and they all have really cool solutions to them, then we're heading somewhere cool. And a lot of this has to be business, because it's not like a consumer at home, you know, can solve everything on their own. Many times, you know, you can only really create a solution to something when you collect millions of it, because then you have enough to make it worth your while.
Well, here in Vermont, we, at least in northern Vermont, we've been going from a multi stream recycling collection to a single stream, because they're up in Chittenden County. There's a MRT, I forget what it stands for, but basically a big sorting machine. And so that's made it easier for people just to throw everything together. It sounds like you're pushing people in exactly the opposite direction, to have lots and lots of little tiny streams, wrappers from individual candy manufacturers.
Yeah, it's an important thing to note is that, like, our candy collection, any brand is acceptable in it.
Okay.
But we do distinct down between, like, a chip bag is a different box, the candy wrapper is a different box, the, you know, media, like DVDs, VHS tapes are a different box.
Mm.
What we found, and this is maybe the best metaphor, is in nature, like, nature has all the solutions, right? And in nature, nature doesn't have a one-stop shop for all garbage. It's not like everything has the same solution. If a leaf falls off a tree, a different thing happens to it than if an animal dies in the forest. It's, in both ways, those are, in effect, waste of one system, also the raw materials for a completely different system. And, you know, a maggot may go and eat the body, and a
Hello?
Different Hello?
You're still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we heard some very strange sounds, as if you were on a tape and the tape got scrambled. But, okay, go ahead.
So the point is, in nature, you have different solutions for different types of waste. And that's the same thing that happens, that has to happen in the human system. So we believe strongly that separation is critical, and that you need to separate, you know, the waste out into its components, because then you can really work with it and create solutions to it. So, you know, there's two schools. One is, you know, put it all in one box and then it'll get separated at the recycling center. And the other, which is what we're trying to do, is we'll actually pay you to collect, but we do ask you that you separate it into its all its basic components. And I can tell you, people are very happy to separate. We've had no issues with that at all.
Hmm. Well, Tom Zaki, you describe in your book Revolution in a Bottle how you got started and built a national business built on selling worm poop. Now, here in northeastern Vermont, we have a couple sisters who have built quite a business selling worm poop. And they come on to WDEV occasionally. They go around to farmers markets and small places like that. You promote getting things into big box stores. On this show, I try to plug, you know, farmers markets and Main Street locally owned businesses. And one of the reasons for that is because, you know, with oil becoming more scarce and expensive, I don't think that we'll have the infrastructure to maintain the sort of global or even national shipping economy that we have right now. Could you comment on that?
It's a great question, and it's very ironic that, you know, in effect, I am on your show today, because we work with the exact opposite of that mainly. You know, we sell our products in major big box retail, and we also work with the big giant conglomerates. Our theory on this, and I'm an environmentalist. I want to try to, you know, solve these things, and I think I share a lot of values that I think the ladies that, you know, you bring on your show that do the worm poop thing do as well. The first part of that, the question, is that what we're trying to do is to create as much change in the world as possible. And the if you really want to change business quickly, the only way, at least I know of how to do it quickly, that is to have the big companies change their practices. And so that's been one of our key focuses, is working with the biggest companies out there, from Kraft, you know, to Mars, to Walmart, to Target, to try to get them to see the light and work with us, you know, within our sort of, you know, eco-capitalist mindset. And that's been very successful so far. And I think it goes over to the bigger question. You know, I don't quite know, you know, if at the end of the day oil is going to get so expensive that we're not going to be able to import product, from all over the world. And
about 15 seconds, please. 15 seconds, please, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I think at the end of the day, you know, we need to start by looking at how we can change the big companies. And if we can change them, then we can, in effect, quickly reinvent the way people do business and bring all these solutions to the table.
Tom Zaki is a founder of TerraCycle, a company that makes products entirely from waste. His book is called Revolution in a Bottle, and I imagine it's available at locally owned independent bookstores everywhere?
Yes, it's available at most bookstores across America.
Very good. Tom Zaki, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the theme for today's show is how to turn products that people are not looking at as valuable into value. We have Gleaning from the Vermont Food Bank. We have this whole company redefining green business by turning garbage into products that they sell with value added.
I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's it for today's Equal Time, which was a rebroadcast of interviews from June 22nd. I'll be back next Monday. It's Labor Day, and I'll be wrapping up the end of the summer vacation that I've started this week. So it'll be another rerun, interviews from July. It's a show that I've gotten more response from than any other one I broadcast this summer. It's about how living more like the Amish is good for our mental health. Listen to Equal Time next week at the same time. Thanks for tuning in.